You are listening to inspiring stories of ordinary people doing extraordinary stuff. Welcome to the Doolanders.
Hit it!
That's what I'm talking about.
Wait!
Okay, now, from the beginning.
Hit it, boys.
Here we are, Blake. This is episode 47 of the Doolanders. How are you going?
I am amazing today.
Yeah?
I never felt better.
Why is that?
I don't know. Here with you, sun shining.
Yeah.
It's amazing. It's
great. Freezing cold, alive. Sun shining.
Yeah.
It's a good mix.
It's a perfect Melbourne winter's day.
Mm.
Just brilliant.
That just means meat pies to me.
It does. It does mean meat pies. Now, today we have a rock star, an innovator, an artist, a creator. We've got Scott Pickett on the show who has some of Australia's and Melbourne's best restaurants. When you think about your culinary creativity and abilities, do you remember, you know, what you first rustled up in the kitchen?
Not specifically. I probably should be a better cook than I am. Mum is.
Is she?
And was a very good cook. And I remember, I have fond memories of, you know, helping mum stir pots and things like that. Did that translate into me later in life? Like I like cooking. Mm. I like cooking for a small group of people. Couldn't imagine just doing service after service. But it, you know, wasn't something I sort of didn't get led down that path or didn't find myself in that sort of area. But, you know, it's not a bad thing to do. At the end of the day, bang something out in the kitchen and then be able to enjoy it.
What's your go-to? What about a good curry? Like, do you make a good curry?
I make an okay curry. Ruben loves curries.
Yeah.
But the other two,
not
into it yet.
Okay.
So we're sort of gradually introducing spices and things like that. And anyhow, how about you? When did you start to first turn on the burners? That's the industry lingo, I think.
Is it? Yeah.
I don't know. I doubt it.
Well, my first recollection of cooking something was actually in home economics class in high school. And I remember we had this project to cook a scotched egg. Do you know what a scotched egg
is? Scotty Pickett's just thrown his earbuds into the Yarra River.
He has. Like, a scotched egg is a football-shaped piece of mince around an egg. quite frankly, if I had it, the way that it came out, if I had have thrown that scotched egg at one of my friends and hit them with it, it would have killed them. It was like a brick. It wasn't great. But I have got better over time. I have got better over time. Anyway, that was my recollection. Scotty Pickett. He is a bundle of energy, isn't he?
He is. And, yeah, can't hold him back.
You can't.
And this episode of the Doolanders is something special. It's our first explicit language warning, so congratulations to Scotty. But what I think you'll find from this is someone who found a passion early and just went and continues to go really, really hard at it.
Yeah, he does. And that explicit language warning is a good one. If you are in the car with the kids, the F-bomb probably surfaces, I'd say, nearly into the triple figures. So just a warning for you there.
All right, hope you enjoy Scotty Pickett. Just a reminder, Doolanders, this is part A of our interview with Scotty Pickett. Check out part B after this. Hey, Blake, before we get stuck into this episode,
yeah,
where should our listeners go if they want to hear more stories of people doing?
They should jump on to www.thedoolanders.com.au. And what will they find there, Nick?
No, not .com.au, Blake, just .com.
Oh.
Don't make that mistake. You can hit us up on Facebook. You can hit us up on Instagram and our website, and you can find a whole heap of pictures, articles, links.
Recipes?
Not a ton of recipes, okay. But you just never know what you'll find. Thedoolanders.com. No.au.
Do it. Okay, now, from the beginning. Scott Pickett, welcome to the Doolanders. How are you, mate?
Yeah, good, mate. Thank you.
That's good. Nick, how are you?
Good. Hungry.
Oh, I bet you are. Scott, we always like to ask our guests on the Doolanders, firstly, who are you and what do you do?
Who am I? My name's Scott Pickett. I've got a number of restaurants in Melbourne now. First one is Estelle. It's in High Street, Northcote, that just had its 10th birthday. I opened up St. Crispin about 2 years later that became Lupo. That's been shut during COVID now for about 18 months that I've just finished a kind of refurb design. We're about to start the build process, so that's nice. Going to be called Smith Street Bistro.
When's that going to open?
Should open first or second week of October, pre-Christmas.
Beautiful.
Really cool, casual, bar-driven, drinks-driven, food offering kind of thing.
Nice.
And so that's a beautiful space, beautiful building, so yep. Smith Street Bistro comes on. I've got Matilda in Domain Road, South Yarra. That's named after our only daughter. That's all over wood, fire and charcoal. I've got a restaurant at Chadston, at the Hotel Chadston, that's called Pastore, that's wood-fired Italian. And then during COVID, I bought Long Grain, absolute Melbourne institution, and I took on the lease of Normanby Chambers from Shannon Bennett and built my new restaurant, Chancery Lane.
Wow, you've been busy through COVID, haven't you? We'll touch on that in a minute. But I was before you came on, I was reflecting on just the times that I've walked into restaurants, and I reckon it's one of life's greatest pleasures to be able to walk into a restaurant, sit down with your mates, your family. I think about the conversations that have been had in restaurants. There's celebration, there's commiseration, there's love, laughter, hate. There's all of these emotions that come through. When you think about, you know, your vision for an experience in your large stable and growing stable of restaurants, what type of experience do you try to create?
Ultimately, I want the diner or the guest to have a fucking yummy, tasty dinner and to have a good time, really. And I try to keep everything that we do, I try to strip it back to basics ultimately, because you can get so carried away with yourself, and I've done that throughout my career with what we do and who we are and all this kind of stuff. But ultimately, it's got to be yummy. It's got to be at the right price point. Now, whether that's a $10 sandwich, whether that's a $300 fucking dinner, it doesn't really matter actually. I've got to walk away feeling that I had value for money.
Yep.
And if I decided to order some great burgundy and a bottle of champagne and caviar and some crab and some lobster and the bill's $200, $300, $400, $500 a head, if I feel like I've got value for that, then it's not actually the dollar amount. It's if I walk in, and I might go to Estelle, where on the bar side we do, you know, Tuesday nights we do steak night now because we've built the bar and we still do the dining room and we're there for the locals, and it's a $35 steak and a glass of red.
Yep.
Now that's value, right? So whatever the perception of that value is, I try not to have it as the price point, but I try to have it as the experience. Whether you walk in and on the corner of Chancery Lane, what I like about 3 weeks ago, we've opened up a little deli cafe kind of thing called Le Shop. And that's basically baguettes and healthy salads. Now, you know, that might be the $10 to $20, you know, kind of transaction point, but I've still got to have a great sandwich.
Yeah.
And I've still got to have a great coffee, and I've still got to have that great customer experience, and I've got to have a beautiful venue or a great little fit out as well too. So, yeah, that's really, they're my three kind of things. If we can get those right and try to remember, you know, that my job ultimately is to please people, is to make people happy.
Yeah.
And they'll work out smiling, and they'll be happy in the belly, and they'll smile, and they get good service and good food. If you don't get carried away with it and get that arrogant service where we think we're better than you, or I'm doing you a favour by getting you a drink, like we've all been to those really cool bars and the barman gives you attitude.
Yeah.
And you're like, mate, I've just ordered three cocktails and fucking one of those cocktails actually probably costs more than you get paid an hour. Drop the attitude, get me my drink. I just want to enjoy my night.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want any of that in our businesses. And I'm a pretty real kind of guy, I suppose. Yeah. I like to keep it pretty grounded and pretty honest and real. And I like that to filter all the way through where we actually appreciate that the customer and the guest comes through every time.
Yeah, that's cool. And that's sort of what you touched on there around, you know, that what permeates through your business. So you're creating these amazing experiences. When you think about the culture of your business and your organisation, and I'd imagine, you know, you've, and we'll get to it, the way that you've built your business and your volume of restaurants. When you think about the culture, what do you try to create with your team?
well, I could be really good for culture or I could be really bad for culture, unfortunately. That's the honest truth.
What does that mean?
That means that the culture in my head, in the business, in the hospitality industry has changed a lot. I mean, I'm 30 years in now. I started cooking when I was 14. In 1989, 1990, and, you know, the culture of kitchens and the hospitality industry in the 90s was brutal. Yeah. Like, fucking hard.
Yeah.
Hard. And they were 80, 90, 100-hour weeks, if not more. Whereas if you look now, fast forward 30 years later, you know, most of the staff, aside from the key senior guys, are working 38 to 40, 42, 44 hours. They're looking for more work-life balance. They want better conditions. They want to be treated better. They don't take bollockings like they used to. You know, I can't walk around going as intense as I used to, if you'd like to call that word.
It's a good word. It's a good
intense
word.
Are fucking nuts. Or actually just go hard. So I've had to really tone it back a bit, you know, which comes with age and comes with, you know, that personal sense of achievement and pride in what you do. But it's just a different world, you know. And, you know, that's not really even anything to do with COVID, although that's changed a lot too with the staff's mentality on, you know, do they still even want to work nights anymore? Do they want to work daytimes? Do they want to work weekends? Is a sacrifice that you have to make in hospitality something, you know, that people want to keep doing? And that's kind of changed, you know, during COVID, where people have had to find other work or not being in restaurants and they're questioning themselves.
Mm.
And so that's been a big one too. But, you know, the culture that we now try to feed through the business is I'm always firm but fair. And that's what it is. And there's, you know, there's a hierarchy that I come from that I've been grown up with, you know, that's in kitchens and it's respect and it's where it is and it's respect for the customer, respect for the producer, for the supplier, for your fellow staff member, for front of house, back of house, you know, breaking down the divide between the kitchen and the waiters that, look, I mean, it's a bit like vegetarians. In the 90s, you didn't really care about them. I was a chef. I didn't care about a waiter or a vegetarian. That's a reality.
Yeah.
You know, you didn't, you know, you gave no time to their dish or their food.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, oh, we're going to fucking vegetarian. What are we going to cook for them? And you just sort of do a dish. Whereas when we opened Estelle, and especially where it is in High Street Northcote, that attitude lasted about 6 days until I realised that there was a really big customer base that I was missing out on here.
Yeah, yeah.
And you didn't have dietaries. You didn't worry about gluten-free or fructose or anaphylactic, anything like that. You actually just cook. So, look, that was a brilliant time in my life, but, you know, I want us to be progressive. I want us to change. I want to change and evolve and be the best and be on the forefront of where I see kind of, you know, food and where my industry is. So then rather than it actually just become a pain in the ass every time that we had that dietary, then what we did in 2010, 2011 is I flipped it on its head and I said, okay, let's spend the time to work out a menu and design it so that that person that walks out of Estelle at that stage, you know, that could be vegetarian, that could be vegan, that could be pescatarian, that could have a dietary, that they have the best experience that they've actually ever had in a restaurant.
Yeah.
And they walk away actually having a better experience, you know, than the person next to them. So then we went through sort of menu, you know, testing and development for where we could drop lactose, and then we started making ice creams with soy milk, for instance, so that everybody would get like a rhubarb ice cream or a chocolate ice cream with soy milk, right? But no one would know the difference, but it was actually okay. So we didn't actually have to say, oh, well, this is soy or this or not. It's like, this is this dish. And then, then the person with the dietary might say, like, is this okay for me? And it's like, yeah, it's fine for you. And then we looked into rice flours, into water chestnut flours, into different starches, potato starches. So how we might make a sponge for, say, or actually finish something with flour but then change it, and then the whole table, you know, could actually just enjoy the experience.
Cool. Northcote, the vegetarian capital of the world, apparently. So I'm interested also, you know, you think about the design of your restaurants, like the ambience, the ambiance, whatever you want to call it. Who does that? Like, have you got people that you work with and you've worked with for years, or is it, do you dream that up, or how does that all work?
It's a bit of both. It's kind of in my head, and I kind of know what I want the restaurants to look like and what I want them to feel like. And then with each restaurant, we've kind of had different designers, different architects, you know, different firms, different people. But that's only really been since Matilda. With Matilda, we work closely with Projects of Imagination, so they kind of interpret, you know, what's in my head. But if you look at Estelle, St. Crispin, ESP, which was kind of when Estelle was split into Bistro and Estelle by Scott Pickett. That was all really designed. I designed that on the fly with my builders, actually, and I just ordered it and was really involved in the process. ESP, I mean, I pretty much, we would just cut stuff and say, right, so how high do we want the bench? And I'd go, yeah, about there. And then we'd build the bench, we'd build the kitchen, and I kind of know my levels at where, you know, standard kitchen benches might be 8850, but they're a bit low for me and for the modern guy. So now we've made them 950, 100 or a metre, then where the fridges do it, you know, we'll slide under, then what the plinth height is, and then what I want the return to be, what the standard height for a chair is, a table, all that kind of stuff. So when you've done a few, I know. And so Matilda, I work closely with the team from Projects of Imagination. With Chancery Lane, my latest one was with Wendy Bergman, Bergman & Co. And then with Smith Street Bistro and a couple of other projects on the go. Wonderful designer and architect by the name of Sarah Townsend. She's got a group called Anthology. So we designed Smith Street Bistro. We stood in there and it's been in my head for years. Like the restaurants kind of sit in there. And we stood in the space and in about 25 minutes, like I told her what I wanted and she came back 2 days later and like, here's the renders, here's the drawings, what do you reckon? And it was kind of 90% there. Yeah. And then I just changed the booth depths. And I get pretty obsessive about these things, like down to the height, to the cutlery, to how far the booth comes out, to what the fabric is, to what it's going to be. And she kind of got all that. So that was, you know, probably the easiest one.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's kind of there and then it just comes out.
Nice. So it's you're not just thinking about, geez, we're going to produce some amazing food. It's the whole package, right?
Probably in the early days I did.
Yep.
And I did. I did just cook. I cooked and that was my job. That's what I was meant to do. That stage of my life, probably till about my mid-30s, you know, that's what I should have been doing. I should have just been cooking 100 hours a week or 50 hours a week or whatever I chose to work, I suppose. But then as my role in the restaurants changed, as I understood – you know, the importance, I suppose, of the front of house, of the design. Whereas, you know, when you're a young man in your 20s cooking hard, you know, you don't give a fuck about any of that. It's like the food on the plate, that's it.
Yep.
That's all I cared about. That's all I call that. That's really all I cared about from 15 to 30. And I wouldn't change that at all because that was me mastering my craft and my art. So now that's embedded in my brain.
Yeah.
But then when you start to actually appreciate and understand that it's bigger than you, that a dining experience is more than you, that it is the whole package, that's when it really unlocked another part of my brain that I really enjoyed, the design, the colour, the schemes, the ideas, you know, the sequence of service. Like I'll understand that probably now more than most restaurant managers and our kitchens are open because I know the process of a dining experience, what it should be, and then what I expect. So that really helps me as a kind of restaurateur and an operator to see those things.
Yeah, super cool. I think I look at your profession, I go, shit, these guys, like they sweat a lot. They look like they're always under the pump and under a whole lot of pressure. And I guess that's due to the time pressures that you're under. When you think about your relationship with pressure over time, you know, 15 years that you spent focused specifically on food and pushing out amazing food and then, you know, what your business has become, how is your relationship with pressure and has it changed over time?
Yeah, I love pressure, actually. It's a thinker. Yeah, completely. It's a drug. And then so is a big service in kitchens too. And so is a big service. I love service. I still do 5 or 6 dinner services a week.
Yep.
You know, I don't do as much mise en place anymore at 45 as I used to, like basically prep. I don't clean as much beef fill and peel as many potatoes. But I really kind of run the business. I'm in the business running my business from about 9 till 4 or 5 and then I choose a venue to be there for dinner service and enjoy that till 10 or 11 and then I go back to my office in Northcote for an hour or two just to wrap up my day. But I love the pressure. You know, the pressures change. But that adrenaline, you know, there's not many other things that I've ever done in my life and I've done a lot of crazy wild things in my life.
Okay.
But there's not many that go to a big service in a kitchen.
Yeah.
And I thrive under pressure. I perform best and I could not get enough of it really. It's when it really amps me up. I mean, I'm an obsessive, compulsive, intense individual anyway and I've always had crazy amounts of energy. So it just kind of suits my breed.
How do you get the most out of your people? Like you thrive on it, right? Mm. But I would imagine that there's people in the corner that are sweating bullets when going, yes, chef, I'll do that. Like how do you get the most out of them?
Oh, well, sometimes you don't want to, you know. Okay. You know, that can be enjoyable as well too, seeing someone in the corner sweating bullets, you know. Yeah. Like, it works both ways. That can yeah. be, that person can be an inspiration to the rest of the brigade as well too. So there's different ways. I mean, now I manage people. I have a random management style that some people like, some people don't, that some people look at and go, Chef-O, what are you doing? They call me Chef-O, right? It's very Australian, right? You just add an O on the end. It's either Digger or Chef-O.
Yeah.
Digger was probably a bit more late 90s, early noughties, but Chef-O's going to last, you know, 10 years. I think you need to manage the individual. And as of, like, I mean, I took over my first kitchen 2005, 2006 at the point. So it's been 15 years now. And over that period of time, in the early days, it was just intense. It was hardcore. There was no management style aside from just bollocking someone, you know, give me that fucking beef in 3 minutes, that's it. Like, there was no, it was very strict. It was very much, you know, that's it. You know, that's toe the line or usher out. Now I really look at the individual. Some guys and girls, you know, they respond to that, right? They like a little touch up. They like to be pushed. They like to. Other people don't. They break. Now, you know, the saddest inside me used to probably enjoy breaking people when I was a crazy wild man, and it was just part of it. There were a few casualties along the way. That was like a hard service, and it was true. That's how I was trained. That's, you know, London in the 90s, you either stepped up and performed or you're fucking out. Like, it's really that simple. Now it's changed a lot. The world's changed a lot. I'd like to think I've changed a lot as well too. Now you look at the individual as to where you can inspire them or lead them, or do they need a quiet word? Do they need to be pushed? Do they need to, you know, to just be left alone? Do they need a time frame? You know, how can you actually manage them? But I think, you know, the biggest thing is that I try to lead from the front.
Yeah.
And there's nothing in the business that I will not do and that I will ask anybody to do that I wouldn't do myself. Like, I'll still change the bit if it's full.
Yeah.
If I'm really shitty on a Friday night and it's 9:30, then I'll go in into the pot wash and I'll do dishes for an hour. And they'll be like, chef, I'll do the dishes. I'm like, actually, leave me alone, because this is the best hour of my week. And it's very therapeutic. Yeah. And I set everything up and I clean everything down and I become obsessive. And then I just do plates for an hour and I actually really, really like it. Or pots and pans. It takes me back to the early days.
Yeah.
And if you do things like that, and if you do anything in the restaurants, then the team will do anything for you that you are. So I think it's important to lead from the front, be there a lot, you know, be in there to communicate, to talk with them, you know, to try to help them and train them and show them, you know, what's in my mind and how we can get that onto a plate and into the dining experience.
Super cool. Hey, Matt, it's been a massive, massive 18 months, I'd imagine. COVID-19, lockdowns and everything goes with that. And, you know, it's really shattered the industry. But outside of looking in, and, you know, this is the first time that we've met, it appears to me that you've run at this thing, right? You actually
yep.
ran at COVID-19 and said, right, I'm going to take you on, which seems to be your way. So you actually innovated, right? So you've, you know, stood up home delivery, you've inspired the industry and the masses with Digger Goes Rogue.
Yeah,
and
a few wild
videos. You better tell people about that.
Yeah.
And you've grown the business with Chancery Lane and Long Grain. Like, when all that was going on, what was your mindset?
My mindset was, I went home one day and the penny actually dropped, and I'll never forget the day. It was the 23rd of March last year, actually. And I'm like, fuck, I could actually lose everything and it's completely out of my control and there's nothing that I can do.
Mm.
And I'll work as hard as I can. I'll sacrifice as much as I can to ensure that we don't lose the house, we don't lose the restaurants, we don't lose people's jobs, we can't, you know, pay the suppliers or the bank back. And I've always been a bit of a risk, you know, like a risk sort of taker. And I think at that point, even though, you know, we'd always, you know, there'd been a fair amount of debt during the business that you clear, you go through ebbs and flows where we borrow money, we open, we pay it back, we go, we roll it again. I just, you know, kept kind of doubling down over the last 10 years, I suppose. But when I accepted that that could all go and it was completely out of my control, there was a sense of freedom. And there was a sense of, it actually doesn't fucking matter at all, really, to be honest with you. Like, I'll still have my brain, I'll still have my IP, I'll still have my brand, I'll still have my skills as a chef. And worst case scenario, once this is all over, then maybe I'll end up going to another country if I have to. Maybe I'll go to Japan, maybe I'll just go to the country, maybe I'll do something else, maybe I'll go and buy a little property and do a farmhouse and grow some vegetables and cook. Like, it actually then gave me this entire sense of freedom to do whatever I want.
What a great way to look at it. And tell us about Digger Goes Rogue.
Yeah, Digger.
What was that all about?
And our Digger Goes Rogue came through. So my nickname that I got in London in 99 when I first started at the Square was Digger. And basically the head chef there, Rob Weston, and so the owner, Phil Howard, he's still a good friend of mine, great mentor, wonderful man. But his head chef, Rob, had just come from Marco Pierre White. He'd been head chef there for about 5 or 6 years with Marco. He'd been at the Gavroche with the Roux brothers. He'd been in France, like with Guy Savoir. And him and Phil were best mates. And so they used to share the kind of kitchen things because we did 5 days lunches to dinner, Monday to Friday, then Saturday, Sunday lunches. So we did 12 services a week and they'd kind of do 6 each and then 1 or 2 that shared. So there was always one of them there. And then Rob was a pretty intense guy, you know, pretty intense, you know, long time at Marco's and he was brutal, but he was also very, very funny. Great banter, great crack. It was just, you know, a hardcore English kitchen and just lots of fun. And so there was myself, there was another guy named Scott that was from New Zealand, and there was Brett that was another Aussie that then went on to open the Ledbury, actually. That's a 2-star in Notting Hill with Phil. And every time that Riot and Rob lived in Australia for a couple of years, and so did Phil. So they knew Australians, you know, quite well in the country. And every time they'd say Aussie or Skippy, me and fucking Brett would answer. And every time he said Scott, then me and the Kiwi would answer, and then one day, about 2 months in, Rob cracked the shits. He goes, right, this is it, I've had enough. You're Digger, you're Kiwi, and then what's left for you, you can be fucking Dingo. And so we each got a nickname, and then the Digger kind of stuck and kind of became an alter ego that got me through my tough times in London, and then it's just for many years, the guys that I know back from there, you know me as Digger or as that person. Mm. That was a hardcore, intense person, and then that kind of moved through. And then I kind of calmed down a little bit. But the first day that we were doing takeaway for lockdown, my general manager, Kim Burkers, came to me and said, Chef O, we need to do a little video. You know, let's do something for Instagram, you know, talk about the takeaway, what we're doing. Could you do a little video? And I'm losing my shit at this stage because we've just shut, you know, 6 restaurants. No one else. I'm like, fucking video? I'm doing a video? She goes, Chef O, please just come and talk about the beef that we're doing tonight and the thing. Everyone will love a little Insta story. I'm like, right, that's it. I'm going, fucking rogue. And she goes, well, I'm like, I'm rogue. I'm over this. We're going to lose everything. I was in a foul mood. So then she stood at the pass and I just let all my emotions out and did this wild first video of like what we were cooking. And it was pretty intense and hardcore. And then it just got unbelievable feedback that it then became this thing that I did every day pretty much last year with skits and comedy and stand-up, and it just became fun, and it was kind of my outlet during COVID. Like, we did like a Good Friday special where I got fishing rods and fish and a couple of the boys in, and we're just playing around and just me letting out probably what I was feeling and a lot of Australia was feeling in a really crazy way that made me look like a lunatic. So I was just going rogue and wild. It was fun.
But yeah, well, that's it. You know, you were entertaining, you were making what was a crazy, crazy situation some fun. Hey, let's go back to where it all sort of began. You touched on it back in Adelaide. So your old man built submarines and your mum was an executive assistant for the chairman of Shell, and I've got on pretty good authority that she actually wrote his speeches for him.
Yeah, she did. She was the woman behind the man and a couple of great men. Actually, if you look at my mother's a super intelligent person, and I think if she was born in a different era that she would have loved to have gone to university and studied and probably been a CEO, like a hard bitch that could run a company really, really well.
Yeah.
And then after Shell, she was basically did the same role for the head of medicine at Flinders University for about 10 years before she retired. So pretty impressive and, you know, gave me a lot of intense sort of mongrel in me a little bit, I think.
So that's where it comes from, okay.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, okay. So you did a deal, like cooking back then wasn't as sexy as it is right now, right? But you did a deal with them where you wanted to take a year off school. Take us through that.
And so we'd moved from Melbourne. My father's from Adelaide. We went there on holidays. We went to see where he was born in Clarendon. That's about south of Adelaide by about 35, 40 minutes. Beautiful, just near McLaren Vale there, stunning part of the world. Saw where the old man was born and ended up buying a property in a little town called Kangaroola. That's like the next suburb over, really. And the folks, you know, they're like, right. So I was going from year 8 to year 9 and they're like, right, you know, before I get too entrenched in high school, you know, good time to move. So I went from Melbourne to Adelaide And they said, okay, you're going into Year 9. I said, I'm not going into Year 9. They said, why? I said, well, I'm going into my third year of high school. And the school systems in South Australia are different to Victoria. So you start a high school there in Year 8 and here in Year 7. And I said, well, actually, I'm doing third year of high school. I don't want to worry about the prep bit and the reception bit. So if I was in Adelaide, I'd be 8, 9, 10. So I firstly made a deal with the headmaster and said, I'll do Year 10. And if I don't get straight A's for anything, then I'll go back to Year 9. But if not, I'm going to Year 10. And because I'm a December baby, like I was kind of could go either way. And so I did the first semester and I smashed everything and I stayed in Year 10. So I was only 14 by the end of Year 10. And that's where this started really, because then we did work experience and I was only 14 when I did work experience. And in Adelaide, you get your driver's license at 16. Yeah. I was living in the farm. I wanted to get my P's and save for a car. So I did work experience at the local winery at the old Clarendon Winery. And I did that all the way through Year 11. And I pretty much studied, worked 30 to 40 hours a week from Friday, Saturday, Sundays and played footy. And then it got to Year 11, the end, and they offered me like an apprenticeship. And so I went to my parents. I said, look, I really want to cook. I've loved it, rah, rah. And so the deal that I made was if I love cooking and I do really, really well as an apprentice, then I can follow that path. But if not, then I can go back to school and I've had a year of life and I've grown up a little bit and then I'll do Year 12. And I would have been at the same stage finishing school at the same age if we had have stayed in Victoria. Needless to say, I never went back to school. I love cooking so much and it was amazing and it was great. But it definitely wasn't something, I mean, I was going to go. And I love school. I found it really easy. I really enjoyed studying. I enjoyed numbers that I still do today. I was going to go and do, you know, commerce or banking or, you know, finance or, you know, law or something, really. Yeah. And that's what my parents wanted me to be, one of the first ones to go through university in our family. We just didn't do it. You know, it just hadn't happened before. So there was a year that they were disappointed at the start. But the deal that my mother said to me was, and this one I say to my children and stuff too now, is it doesn't matter what you do as long as you try your best and be the best, you know, chef you can be or the best gardener or the best accountant or, like, it doesn't matter. Just try your best and try to be the best in that profession that you choose. So that was a deal that I still think about every day today.
Yeah, fantastic. Mm. You've said that when you first walked into a kitchen, you found your place.
Yep.
You found your people and you've often referred to it as your stainless steel asylum.
Yep, yeah. For sure.
How did it make you feel when you walked in and how does it still make you feel today?
I felt at home.
Right.
Just felt comfortable. Like I just felt like I'd found.
Isn't that an amazing thing? Yeah, walk into a place and go, shit, this feels right.
Yeah, completely. And to find that at 14, like I don't go to work, right? I never go to work. I just wake up and I live my life. And my life happens to now be running the restaurants. But for many, many years, it was just being in a kitchen. And I just go there and it's just fun. And I enjoy the cooking and I enjoy the banter and I enjoy the pressure and I enjoy the creativity. I enjoy making a sauce still or doing the butchery or, you know, filleting a whole fish and then pushing myself every day to, you know, to portion that salmon better than I did yesterday or to weigh something better or to be more precise or to be more innovative or to be different. So, yeah, it's crazy. It's wild. I mean, I feel that I'm very fortunate because I know a lot of people, you know, they go to work and work's not their life. They go there Monday to Friday, 9 to 5. They can't wait to go out for lunch or finish off. But they're really, yeah, their life is outside of that time. Whereas mine's just become sort of enveloped into sort of one continual movement that is just, you know, my life is the food and the restaurants and the family and it just kind of intertwines.
That's the end of part A of our interview with Scotty Pickett. Check out part B next.